This episode is presented by Forever Cheese, a passion for great taste. Learn more at forevercheese.com.
This week on Meet and Three, I'm about to go on maternity leave. This is Katie Mosman-Wadler, and before I leave you in the incredibly capable hands of Team HRN, we're rounding out Season 5 with a deep dive into the food rules, weird cravings, and overall hype about eating while pregnant.
There are a lot of safe foods to eat, and we shouldn't be sort of assuming that just because something is raw that it's dangerous.
I just found myself feeling like there was an alien piloting my body and brain, and totally changed the way that I ate.
So was it the eggplant? Sure. Why not? I just don't know.
Tune in to this week's episode of Meat and Three anywhere you listen to podcasts. I'll be back soon with our newest and tiniest producer in tow.
This is Lisa Held coming to you live from Full Service Radio at the Line Hotel in Washington, D.C., and you're listening to The Farm Report, a Heritage Radio Network show about the people, processes, and policies that shape how food is produced today. So first of all, Happy New Year. I know it's January 14th, but this is our first episode of 2020, and I'm really looking forward to a new season. So first off, to celebrate the new decade, we're going to be talking about the production of one of the most delicious foods imaginable, which is maple syrup. Naturally, my guests today are both calling in from Vermont. First, I have seventh generation farmer or sugar maker Arnold Coombs of Coombs Family Farms. Welcome to the show, Arnold.
Thank you, Lisa.
And also joining us is Mark Isselhart, a maple specialist at the University of Vermont Extension School. Mark, thanks for being here.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
All right. So we're going to be talking all about maple. I want to start with a little terminology before we get into this conversation. So this is the Farm Report, and I think we need to clarify something. Arnold, do you call yourself a farmer? Are maple producers farmers? What is the right word for this?
Normally, we call ourselves sugar makers.
Mm-hmm.
We are farmers, but sugar maker is the phrase that we all use.
But is it interchangeable? Like, the company is Coombs Family Farms, so, like, do you use both at different points?
From a marketing spec point, it's mostly farmer.
Mm.
But internally in the industry, it's, you know, are you a sugar maker? He's a good sugar maker, whatever it might be.
Okay, so as insiders, we should use sugar maker.
I guess. And, you know, where the syrup is produced, it's a sugar house.
Right.
And the forest is called a sugar bush.
Perfect. So why don't you tell us a little bit about Coombs Family Farms? So what's the history? It sounds like there is a long history. And what does the company look like today?
Well, there is a long history. We started as a family making syrup sometime in the early 1840s. We're not sure the exact date.
Wow.
And we're sugar makers slash farmers for generations. And then in 1925, my grandparents started a maple candy business where they would take the syrup and turn it into maple candy, and then they started packing syrup and selling it to stores.
Okay.
That business grew. My father joined it, and I joined it in 1985. It was kind of on its last legs, and my folks and I sold it. They retired, and I started another one, which is now Coombs Family Farms. And then I merged that with another company called Bascom Maple Farms, Bruce Bascom. And coincidentally, he's the seventh generation of his family in the maple business as well.
Wow.
We've known each other for generations. You know, I'd been over there when I was a kid, so we knew each other well. And we joined forces because there's a lot of competition coming into the industry that we thought we wouldn't survive independently, but we have strength in numbers, and it has worked out fairly well. We've grown considerably since then.
Right. And you source maple from all different sugar makers, is that right?
Correct.
Yeah.
A few thousand. We have our own farm. We tap about 105,000 trees, but we also buy from many farmers.
Right. And you mentioned competition. So, you know, I was looking at the stats, and Vermont is the top producing state. And production in the U.S. has grown so much. I was really surprised in the past decade. I mean, the USDA Ag Census showed the gallons of syrup produced in the U.S. almost doubled between 2012 and 2017. I'm curious, so maybe Mark, if you could weigh in, as someone who's been studying maple for a long time, have you been following this growth, and do you have a sense of what's fueling it?
Sure. Yeah, the expansion, I would probably peg to the last 20 years, and it is dramatic. You know, we're producing, in Vermont anyway, about 2 million gallons of syrup a year.
Wow.
And about 20, 25 years ago, that number was closer to 500,000 to 600,000 gallons. So there's been a dramatic change over that period of time. There's not one simple thing that you could say fueled that expansion, but there are several key factors. One actually has to do with Canada and how the Canadian maple industry is organized.
Hmm.
In Canada, the province of Quebec really produces the vast majority of syrup. In fact, Quebec produces over 70% of all the world's maple syrup just in one province.
Wow.
And the way they structured their market up there, there's a government-sanctioned entity that works to market all that syrup. So if you're a producer of syrup and you're selling in bulks, basically selling in a barrel,
right,
you have to sell into that one central agency, and then they do the marketing from there. And what they do, they have the ability then, with such a large market share, to basically set the world price. They also have, which you may have run into in your research, is a strategic maple syrup reserve, which, you know, depending on your sense of humor, you might you might laugh at, but it is actually a critical part of how they market their syrup. Maple is very, very dependent on certain temperature fluctuations during the production period.
Right.
And not all years are ideal. And by having a reserve of syrup, which is not as perishable as other commodities like milk or that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
When you have that in reserve, you can release some when years aren't as ideal as others, and it moderates the supply.
Huh.
So the last thing about the Quebec organization is that it's really only relates to producers within the province, and they have a quota system so that you really aren't paid above your above the quota that you have.
Okay.
So there's a limit on production there. That those limits don't extend beyond the province. And so with a good price for syrup and people marketing syrup globally, people outside the province saw the benefits of increasing yield, production, I should say.
Mm.
And that's where you see Vermont really taking off, and other states as well, but Vermont having so much of the remainder of the world's crop, the growth was greater.
Right. Well, and it's interesting, you know, you're saying like there's a lot of demand for it around the world for maple. And in the past few years, there's been a lot of growing attention in the health and nutrition world about how bad sugar is for human health. But maple is not, it sort of like hasn't been looped into that. It seems like it's really positioned as this healthier alternative to white sugar or other sugars. Have you seen that happening? Like, do people see it differently?
Is that a question for me or for Arnold?
Either one. Maybe Mark, if you've looked at the research on,
Well, it's not research that we do here at the University of Vermont specifically, but we are aware of work that's being done. There's been quite a bit of work done actually at the University of Rhode Island, looking at the nature of the chemical composition of maple syrup, what's in there, and how those naturally occurring compounds may or may not have health benefits. And there's been quite a bit of work done, and it's a pretty unique product for sure. There are no additives to maple syrup. It's just a single ingredient, maple sap, that's boiled down. And it's produced in a sort of a semi-wild way. You know, you don't have huge cultivated areas with synthetic fertilizers. It's a minimally managed natural forest ecosystem that produces the sap.
Right.
So it's attractive for that reason as well.
Yeah. And there's also, I guess, in nutrition research been increasing attention to phytonutrients and like the, you know, antioxidants like polyphenols and maple, it's sugar, but it has all these like phytonutrients and minerals and other things all naturally occurring. So I'm sure that helps the appeal for sure. So Arnold, I would love for you to talk a little bit about like what maple production looks like in Vermont at a commercial scale right now. Because, you know, when I picture maple syrup, I picture like my neighbor growing up would like bring his buckets and tap his trees in our yard. And, I don't think that's really what it looks like as much anymore. Can you talk a little bit about like what most producers, like the systems they're using and what it looks like?
Sure. The vast majority of producers now are using a tubing system. They no longer use buckets.
Mm-hmm.
It just really reduces the labor. It makes it much more convenient for collection. It allows trees that you would never have tapped with buckets to be tapped because they're up on a hillside or off in the distance. It also does much less damage to the forest because you don't need roads to get through there to gather the sap from buckets. And so most people are using tubing systems. One man can probably handle 10,000 taps on tubing, whereas with buckets, maybe it's 500 taps.
Right.
So it's much more efficient. We now use a smaller diameter spout, which is healthier for the tree, does less damage than you would with a spout that a bucket would require. And so there's a lot of modern things going in that direction. Farmers will use a vacuum system, so we literally suck the sap down the pipeline, make sure we get it fresh. And then it's boiled in a very efficient evaporator. Some still use wood. Probably more use oil and steam to heat the syrup, boil the sap into syrup.
Mm.
So much more efficient in that sense. There's been a lot of efficiencies developed over the last 25 years, much at the Proctor Maple Research Center, where Mark is, and also by industry in itself.
Right.
So that's why you've seen the numbers grow as well.
Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. How big is a typical like maple farm in Vermont? Or is there a big range in terms of like small to larger scale?
There's a lot of small ones.
Okay.
So in the 500 to 5,000 tap range, there's a lot, hundreds and hundreds of them, well over 1,000 or maybe even two. Maybe Mark knows better than I do. And then there's the larger commercial ones of 20,000 taps and up, where at 20,000 you can probably make a living on your own. You don't have to, necessarily have other work. And if you get up to more, then you can support your family, and that is what you do. You are focused on maple full time, and it's not just a seasonal thing. But when you're in it as a business, you're working in the woods year round for the most part.
Right. Well. Sorry, go ahead, Mark.
Well, I was just going to say that one of the neat things about the maple industry is that there isn't a huge barrier to entry. You know, what matters is the quality of the product you make. So if you're doing everything right and you're putting it in the bottle and you're selling it in the marketplace, either at a farmer's market or a store down the road, you can be part of the industry as well. Everyone has to play by the same rules as far as quality, so making sure the density's right, the flavor's right, and that everyone contributes to what the industry is. So it's pretty nice that way.
Yeah, and Arnold, you brought up that some maple producers are just doing maple, right, and then some farmers do it as part of another operation. Like I read an article about maple as a crop for farmers, for dairy farmers potentially. Is that typical, and is there a big opportunity there? I'm thinking about, it's obviously harder than ever right now for small farms, especially small dairy farms, to make money and to survive. Are a lot of farmers using maple as a means to add income to their operations?
A lot of them are. It's not necessarily new. It's been going on for generations. It's a time of year when there's not a lot of other farm work to be done.
Right.
You know, the fields are covered with snow. If you can get out there and gather sap and boil it down, you're making income in a downtime of the year, essentially.
Right.
So that's always been going on. As the profitability of maple has gone up over the last 20 years, we're seeing maybe more farmers switching to a bigger emphasis on the maple production and growing that side of it. Some farmers getting out of dairy completely and focusing specifically on maple. We did that ourselves. Bascom's used to have just about a 300-head dairy farm, and probably 15 years ago sold the herd and just focused all on maple. We lease out the farm now. We still own it. We just lease out. Someone else is doing the herd management. But, you got to be focused on dairy to really make any money, and our business was maple at the time, so we decided to move on.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it seems like diversification can really help when it comes to small farms. And
absolutely.
I guess the big thing is you need access to maple trees, right? Like, I guess but in Vermont, a lot of farmers probably do have, like, them on their property somewhere, right?
A lot of farmers do, or you can lease your neighbor's trees. It's very easy to work out an agreement where, say, a landowner has 1,000 or 2,000 taps nearby, and you can go in and for a certain amount per tap, you can lease those trees and collect the sap and boil it into syrup. That's how a lot of farmers expand, is by leasing neighboring trees.
Got it.
The vast majority of that increase in production that we've seen over the last 20 years have really come from the conversion of stands that were managed for long-term timber management and now converted to what we call sugar bush, which is the term for stands that are managed for sap production. So there's been areas typically a little more upper, I wouldn't say high elevation, but upper elevation from where most dairy farms are. Those stands were owned and managed for timber production, and harvesting happened periodically. And as maple has come on as a more stable income, because you get an annual income either from producing it yourself or from the rental lease rates that Arnold was talking about, it's become attractive for more landowners.
Well, and that brings up another point I want to talk about, which is the impact on forests. But we have to take a quick break, so let's do that. And when we come back, we'll talk more about the relationship between maple and environmental impacts. We'll be right back.
This episode is presented by Forever Cheese, a passion for great taste. Forever Cheese sources a curated collection of unique cheeses and specialty foods from Italy, Spain, Portugal, and Croatia. They have pioneered numerous important products that are now integral to today's market, including many under their brand Matica. Learn more at forevercheese.com.
All right, we're back. You're listening to The Farm Report on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Lisa Held, and I'm here with Arnold Coombs and Mark Isselhart, and we are talking about maple syrup production. So we left off with this question about maple and environmental impact. And Mark, you mentioned, forests that were maybe before being used for timber. I would love for you to talk a little bit about, is there evidence that supports a correlation between maple production and forest conservation?
Well, it's a wide open topic. Lots of things to cover.
Okay.
Maybe I'll hit on a few of the high points as I see it. So sugaring has been done for a long, long time. There's a long history of it. And as Arnold said, most producers early on were using buckets or some approximation of a bucket to collect the sap, and making the, you have to make a wound in the stem each mm-hmm. time, each year. So you are doing a little bit of damage to the individual tree when you make that hole.
Okay.
As technology has increased, we've actually found that we can produce the same or even more sap with smaller holes, so a correspondingly smaller wound. With the advent of modern vacuum tubing, we can actually extract more sap. So there's sort of this back and forth about positives and potential negatives. And one interesting thing is that, you know, we're talking about a hardy perennial plant, the sugar maple, mm-hmm. and in some cases red maple people are tapping, that are really well adapted to the climate. So they handle, it's not just tapping, there's all their stresses in the environment, and sugar maple tends to be pretty good at withstanding some of those injuries. But modern sugaring is relatively new, and so we're curious about what impact it might be and how that's different from historical collection practices.
Mm.
We're about 6 years into a research project here at the University of Vermont looking at that and comparing modern sugaring with more traditional levels of sap extraction, as well as no tapping, you know, trees in the same stand. And after 6 years, we're not seeing a difference, but we tap trees for more than 6 years. So we'll continue that study into the future and see if differences exist, are they significant, and, you know, what can be done as a result. The two things impacting sustainability from the tree's perspective would be the wound. So we're drilling a hole into that tissue.
Right.
And the tree responds to the wound by walling off that hole, just like it would if it was a woodpecker hole or if it was a branch that was broken off. The tree is very well programmed to respond to those injuries. The other one is a little bit different, and that's how much sugar we're taking out. And since we are able to take maybe twice as much as we have in the past, does that make a difference?
Mm.
All the complexity goes along with it, not the least of which is how big the tree is. So bigger trees store a tremendous amount, and we really can only take so much out of each individual tap hole. So the issue of sustainability still needs to be looked at over a longer period, but it appears, at least in the short term, that modern methods are not any less sustainable than historical processes.
Right.
Then you have the broader sort of landscape-wide questions of, okay, what are the issues of managing for a few species rather than a diverse suite of species? And most sugar makers who are certified organic, or almost all, have to retain some non-maple species in their forests as basically a check against the issues related to a monoculture, where if a pest were to come through, you could have a pretty devastating event, defoliation or something like that. So there's small individual tree issues, and then there's broad sort of landscape type issues involving with sugaring.
Right. But, and I mean, overall, are there, you know, I'm also just thinking about the fact that, so there's all these potential issues with like a little bit of damage to the trees, and we're not sure long term what that means. And then I'm also just thinking about, like, you know, forests hold so much carbon, and like, is there evidence that shows these forests would potentially have been cleared for other, you know, for other purposes, and they're not being cleared and actually cut down because there's money to be made tapping them for maple?
Yeah, I mean, forest management in the Northeast, at least in hardwood stands, there isn't as much of a tradition of like heavy cutting.
Okay.
I mean, there's a little bit, but for the most part, it's more periodic.
Yeah.
Cutting. That being said, you're still probably going to be retaining more carbon, sequestering more carbon in a maturing, well-stocked forest than you would with one that was, you know, had been cut. So,
right.
No, there's all sorts of issues, positive issues with keeping a mature forest intact, from flood mitigation downstream, water quality, carbon sequestration, like you said. So there are a lot of positives about keeping those mature forests intact.
Right. Well, and you also mentioned the organic point that on organic maple farms, they have to retain more biodiversity. And I was going to ask Arnold, I was going to ask you about that because Coombs Family Farms is organic. And I was kind of like thinking, what does that mean when it comes to maple syrup? You know, like I know with production of vegetables, you can't use certain pesticides, fertilizers. Are there in maple production, if it's not organic, are there a lot of chemical pesticides and fertilizers? Like what's different about the way you do things other than the retaining biodiversity?
It's not all that much different.
Okay.
You know, the biodiversity component is big.
Right.
So we have to have a written forest management plan showing that we are practicing sustainable forestry. That's one of the big things.
Okay.
And then it's how we are treating the trees. Are we overtapping them? You know, taking too much sap, doing too much damage.
Mm.
So they will check that out. How are we cleaning our equipment and such? Are we doing that in a proper way? And sometimes during the boiling process, a sugar maple will use a defoamer to keep the foam down. And when syrup or sap hits, say, 214, 215 degrees, it wants to boil like crazy, kind of like when you have pasta going. You
okay.
Know,
mm-hmm.
And so a farmer will use a defoamer to keep it down and just... There's organic defoamers, and so you make sure you're using an organic defoamer for that. And then how do you filter it and store it?
Mm.
So there's no huge home run thing that we have to change, but it's documenting you're doing the right thing and just a few minor changes beyond that.
Right. Okay. And then, so in terms of climate, in kind of in the other direction, Mark, you said earlier that maple harvesting is very sensitive to temperature fluctuations. You know, I'm curious, I guess both of you could answer this question, you know, in terms of research, Mark, on your end, and then Arnold, like if you're seeing this with the sugar makers you work with and on your farm, have changes in weather patterns already started affecting maple production?
Yep, we are definitely seeing the season start earlier and end earlier, and the whole season appears to contract a little bit. That being said, we're seeing, as you saw with your research into the statistics, that production is increasing and yield of syrup per tap is also increasing, and that has a lot to do with technology. But we are seeing the season start earlier than before. It's also important to remember that some of that data on when people first tap, it could have more to do with the scale of their operation and when they need to start in order to be ready for when the season is really kicking in. So, you know, we've already had people produce syrup here in Vermont in the first week in January. That doesn't mean that the season has really begun. It just means that really large operations have to start tapping early, and if you get any amount of good weather for sugaring, you're going to collect some sap and you need to boil it. So broadly speaking, it appears that the season starts earlier, and if people hold to their traditional tapping dates, which tend to be, you know, later in February or early March, there is the possibility that they're going to miss out on some of the sap flow. And it's also important to note that the season might be 6 weeks long, 7 weeks long, maybe a little shorter some years. That doesn't mean that there's an even amount of sap flow over that whole period.
Okay.
The bulk of the crop is made up on a relatively small number of discrete days or events that we call sap runs. And that's when the weather cooperates, the tubing system is running, and everything is working. You can make a huge amount of sap in a relatively short period of time. So it's a little hard to disentangle the season is starting earlier and maybe its overall duration is a little less, and how to reason that with, our yields are actually getting higher. There's some complexity there for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Arnold, what does it look like on your end, just like observationally? Like, does it feel like the season has been changing?
Well, it definitely feels like it's earlier. You know, the old rule of thumb when I was a kid is you tap around town meeting day, the first Tuesday in March.
Mm.
And I don't know of anyone who waits that long now. You'd be missing a good portion of your crop because it's warmer before then.
Hmm.
You know, you got to have the freezing nights and warm days. And it used to be you didn't get too many of them before March, and now you do.
Yeah.
I right now we're getting them. So it's kind of crazy.
Yeah. And is that, I mean, does that affect you? Does that affect, has it affected your production?
Well, as Mark said, farmers are getting more out of the forest now than they were before. And that's mostly to do with technology and just being more efficient and being ready for those early runs that years ago we never were. We've started tapping our trees, and it'll take us a month to get them all tapped. And we're not tapping them now to get the sap necessarily, you know, next week or anything. We just want to be ready in February when, in theory, it's warming up the normal time. And so if it does run, we'll collect it and boil it and do what we do. But everyone seems to be ready earlier now than they ever were. Mm. You just have to be.
There's a few other things to be concerned about. One would be abnormally warm temperatures happening during the season. Mm. You know, typically there's sort of this slow progression of warmth and to the point where you stop having freezing nights, and that's essentially when the season ends. In 2012, we had a pretty odd event where there was about 4 or 5 days in the 70s in March, which is quite warm for Vermont.
Right.
And what that did is it changed the chemistry of the sap. It impacted the ability of the tap hole to produce sap. And this, and from then on, beyond that point, the syrup quality went down and total yield went down. Now, we haven't seen a repeat of that since 2012, but that's definitely a concern because of how dramatic that event was. Now, the last 2 years, the season have actually been delayed a little bit because of too cold weather. So, you know, the high temperatures of 2012 might have gotten a lot of attention within the maple industry. Having it be too cold can also be a concern.
Right.
The other big issue related to climate I want to make sure we talk about is that the concept of species migration gets a lot of attention, not just in maple, but the idea that as the climate warms, you're going to see the traditional sort of assemblage of species that we see now getting kind of reshuffled as different species are better and more competitive. That's definitely a concern to sugar makers, and people are certainly looking at it. And you'll see maps or projections for what the climate might be in the Northeast. It might be more comparable to mid-Atlantic states in the future.
Mm.
One thing that it's important to keep in mind is that sugar makers are very active as far as managing for a few species in their sugar bush. And so I think... you have to have a seed source for some of these more southerly species to show up and establish themselves. And most sugar makers I know are pretty focused on promoting red and sugar maple growth at the expense of others. And so I think those projections are something to take note of, but I know that sugar makers will be paying attention to what the species mix are in their sugar bush and kind of managing accordingly.
Hmm. Another thing that I wanted to ask you about before we wrap up is in my research for this episode, I stumbled on this article about what's called the plantation method, where, you know, it was fascinating to me because maple feels like one of these few foods that we're still kind of getting from the wild, even if it's kind of a farm, but it's still from the forest, you know, tapping trees. And, you know, this new method that's being proposed would essentially allow farmers to plant maples as row crops and get sap from them. Or is this something you all are looking at and thinking about? And do you think that this will catch on?
Well, that research was done here at the University of Vermont.
Oh.
It was initiated by Dr. Abby Vandenberg and Dr. Tim Perkins.
Mm.
And it was a sort of a natural progression of the scientific method of trying to understand where the sap was coming from, and were we taking sap from different parts of the tree with vacuum compared to the old days with buckets.
Mm.
And what they came up with was this concept that perhaps the above ground parts, which in a wild tree or a semi-wild tree are what are really driving the sap flow mechanism, the above ground parts that freeze and draw moisture up into the tree, and then when it thaws, that's the sap you're collecting on each day if you're using just a bucket. But with vacuum, you know, it was sort of thought, well, perhaps the above ground parts aren't as critical as maybe they would be with bucket collection.
Mm.
And so we had some plantations here, and we experimented with a lot of different types of fittings and techniques. And the concept certainly works. You can cut the top off a sapling, and assuming you get a good vacuum seal, you can suck sap out of it.
Hmm.
What is interesting is the tree doesn't die. It's a little bit like if a tree had been subjected to a severe ice storm where a lot of the branches broke off. Those many trees in ice storms don't die, even though it is very dramatic to see.
Huh.
You have what are called dormant buds that are below the bark, and they're kept dormant by the above ground, you know, the branches. They produce chemicals to keep those buds dormant. When that top is removed, those dormant buds are free to grow, and they will as part of the tree's strategy to stay alive.
Mm.
So what will happen is you'll collect sap from the sapling for a little bit, for one season, and then the tree will reflush new leaves, and you can keep going as long as you have tissue to cut into.
Hmm.
I can't really say for sure if it's going to take off as a alternative to the traditional sugar bush.
Right.
I will say that people are certainly interested in it and have planted plantations, and they're becoming ready for tapping. You need really maybe something around 2-2.5 inches in diameter to have it be usable, because you don't get very much sap out of each individual sapling.
Mm.
It's only when you plant at a high density per acre that you would achieve yields that equal or exceed what we see in a normal conventional sugar bush.
Right.
So I'd say it has potential. It's provocative, that's for sure. It gets people's attention. I don't necessarily know if it is the future or not, because there's still a lot of work involved in cutting those tops and attaching those fittings. But we used to cut Christmas trees out of the woods and not go to a plantation to buy them, too.
Right.
But that's changed. So.
Yeah. Arnold, what do you think of it? I'm so curious if there is, like, you know, passionate responses among sugar makers of, you know, this is sort of a new agey way to do it, and you know, we should stick to the sugar bush, or if it's like exciting because it could be more productive. How do you feel about it?
I think we're all kind of like, probably turning up our nose at first.
Yeah.
What are they talking about? But there may be situations where this works. You know, there's an invasive species, Asian longhorn beetle, that does a lot of damage to maple trees. And if that were to get into someone's forest, those trees in that forest would all have to be cut down and chipped. So then the farmer would be essentially out of business. But what if they could have, you know, they had fields they could replant in a plantation format?
Mm.
They would be back in business sooner. It'd still take many years, but they could still be a productive farmer without waiting the 30 to 40 years for their trees to grow back.
Right.
So there's situations where that may be quite productive for a farmer.
Right. Maybe there's room for both methods.
Yes.
Potentially. Great. Well, Arnold, Mark, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
And thank you all so much for listening to the Farm Report on Heritage Radio Network. If you enjoyed the conversation, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, and share it. I'll see you next week.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.